Driver Pickens. Reviews. Comments. Complaints. Go.
One second, we have a microphone now.
Oh, we have a microphone. We can hear each other.
I just wanted some additional clarification. So, with regards to karma, so if something happens to you in this life, like I had a friend who was king hit, how would that relate to his previous life? So, would that be that he had king hit someone in a previous life, or so a retribution of sort, or would it be that he was hit in his previous life?
So all you're asking is if something happens this life, someone gives you some money,
yeah,
you want to know what the cause of it. Yeah. You're asking, something things happen to us all day, would you agree?
Yes.
But they're not just bad, are they? They're good as well.
Yes.
Remember that. So you're asking what's the cause of what happens to us?
Yes.
That's what you're asking, isn't it?
Yes.
Broadly, that's your broad question,
yeah.
Would you agree? Well, the way, to kind of look at it, you know, if someone does to you, like someone, say, gives you something, generous to you,
mm-hmm.
What's it sort of has kind of common sense about it. What would be the cause of that, do you think?
You were generous in the previous one.
There you go. It's like that. I mean, it's clearly way more nuanced, way more sophisticated, way more subtle, in that when you get down to the minuscule of minute-by-minute detail, the general principles of what we're discussing here, that every single thing we experience, every millisecond of everything we think and say and do and that happens to us, including the environment, of every sentient being is the fruit of past actions of that sentient being. That's the general principle. So you look at, you know, if you're lied to, stolen from, bad mouth, king hit, kill, raped, tortured, loved, given things, taken care of, adored, looked after, trusted, etc., etc. Just look at the actions, you can kind of check that. Broadly speaking, do you understand my point? It's like that.
Okay, thank you.
In fact, even that kind of karma, the stuff that happens to us, as opposed to what goes on in here, is even called experiences similar to the cause. Your cause. Do you understand? It's called that. Do you understand?
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Someone else?
Oh, I've been a little bit. I've got a couple of questions. One's like a summation and a clarification.
Mm-hmm.
The next one is a question.
Mm-hmm.
So my summation of Buddhist viewpoint of the lens of our mind being how we think. So the conceptual. So this is about the conceptual framework.
Mm-hmm.
Am I right in saying that? I'm just reiterating. So we need to locate what is breaking our heart. So I'll give an example. I don't want to die thinking I'm a failure. So there's a lot of thoughts that can, oh, I haven't done X, Y, and Z, so therefore I've failed. And if I die tomorrow, I better bloody find out what the cause of this. Because if I keep habituating those thoughts, then I keep repeating, and I'm on the cycle of repeating the past. The past is actually repeated
in
the present.
Even just in this life, you get that, don't we?
Yeah.
That's right. So the idea is trying to learn from our experiences.
Yeah.
You know,
instead of repeating
some negative result of something, like you eat too much cake, you have to learn from the experience. Don't just beat yourself and kill yourself. Learn from the experience and make a decision to change.
Okay. So if our job is to find what if the contribution to that story or whatever we believe about ourselves is conceptual.
It's stories in our mind.
Yeah. So if we're creating these stories of which create our craziness, then our job then is to dismantle it like a bomb.
First, identifying and then if they're all conceptual, if all of what goes on in our mind at a grosser level is conceptual stories, it sounds kind of cute. We don't think of it this way. We think of it as emotional and painful and kind of weird. And we can't locate everything. It's all chaos in there. We have to learn to navigate it. We have to learn to identify. So we use the Buddhist model of some erotic states of mind, some balanced states of mind, some neutral states of mind. You know my point? So we have to learn to use that as our model to begin to identify what's in there.
Right.
Yeah.
And one of the tools to use that is the neutral state of mind.
One of the tools is the skill to focus. the skill to concentrate, which you learn in single point of concentration. And in that technique, you're honing your ability to pay attention in neutral state. You're honing your ability to concentrate. You're honing your ability to discriminate. All these so-called mechanics of the mind, that I like to call that. They're the ones that become very skillful and brilliant and clear. So instead of using those to be a really good sniper or to make a really good cake, you're using those to become a really good practitioner and identify your own mind and unpack and unravel the contents.
Yep, okay. Good. Okay, that's clarified for me. So the question is, if our habit for practicing delusions...
If
as a humankind we have this habit for practicing our delusions...
Well, if we have the habit to be negative, depressed, low self-esteem, jealous, angry, and to be loving, kind, compassionate, wise, intelligent, then...
Well, if we get stuck in the negative habits... And we've already conjectured that it takes 10 or 12 positives to cancel a negative. Well, you know, it's like listening to Dharma all your life and just learning one thing kind of thing, because you have to put your head against the wall and try and put some sense in it. So what makes us habituated to this tendency which tends towards the negative? Why aren't we habituated to the tendency for the positive?
It's obvious.
Just why?
Because you practice that more than the other one.
I know we practice that more than the other one.
That's the answer.
No, but what?
That's the answer.
Okay, so there's no more questions to that.
No, there's no more hidden secret in there. If a little boy wakes up in this life and he's got compassion for the lice, another little boy wakes up in this life, I remember a friend of mine always quote the story, he sees fishing and he runs like a mad, all he wants to do is kill fish. Why do you think one wants to kill fish and why do you think one has compassion for the lice? What's the logical reason?
Yeah, I understand past life.
No, what's the logical reason?
Because one life...
Practice one. So that's the answer. You want a secret answer. There is no other answer than the fact that you've had a habit of that more than the other. One little boy has practiced the virtue, so that overrides his wish to harm the louse, and not only that, he wants to even help it. We can deduce that he's practiced that habit more than the other one. But the one who wants to kill the fish has practiced that more than having compassion for the fish. So it's showing if you can practice either one.
Yeah, I understand.
That's the answer.
Okay.
No further secret to it.
All right. It just seems easier to practice the negative. It seems easier.
But that's because you practice it more.
I know,
No, it's not easier. The little boy who had compassion for the louse, he didn't even know how to have not had compassion. It would have been impossible to be mean. It wasn't easier for him. So whatever you practice is easier.
Yep.
You see my point? For the musician who's perfected how to play Bach, that's easy. It'd be really hard to play wrong music. You see my point?
Yep.
So if you're saying it's easier to go toward the negatives because we practice that more, and yes, I know you like, we do run toward the negative, if that's what we're saying. But if you've already gone so advanced that you've now got rid of that, then you wouldn't be agreeing that it's easier to be negative. But you'd understand it because you've been there before. But once you've perfected how to play piano, you can understand why a person finds it hard to play piano, so you have compassion for them. But you know it's possible to perfect the good one, and it's effortless now to play piano well.
Yep.
You get the point?
Yep.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good. It's a good point. So that should give us courage. Isn't it? Nothing gets more difficult with practice. What else? Nothing?
Yes, Regina.
Where are you?
Here.
Go,
Petal. Hello, everybody. I have a complaint.
Good, okay.
I saw the title of this session with you over the next couple of days, and now, as a retreat, advertised as a retreat, but it seems to me like it's all teachings.
Well, either you were cheated, or you have a misunderstanding of a retreat. Two options.
But I've done retreats in the past and there was more meditation.
That doesn't follow. The retreat doesn't have much meditation. So you've got a conception that a retreat means only silence.
No, not only silence, but more silence than what there is. Like, there seems to be more teaching. Because I saw you in Adelaide and I went there because of the teachings.
That's right.
And I saw a retreat advertised, which
is different
from what it was. There wasn't advertised as a retreat in Adelaide, so I expected...
I understand. Retreats are used in a very broad way for a gathering of people in this context, for either being there watching your breath all day and night, or listening to teachings. So it's both.
Or a mixture.
Huh?
Or a mixture.
Yeah, but What would you want to do instead? It's okay, I understand that. What would you prefer to do instead?
Well, it's people. I just thought there'd be a bit more meditation.
So spell it out what you'd like to do better instead. I'm not being mean or sarcastic. I want to know what you mean by that and what you would like to do that will make you happy.
Yes, to make me happy, a little more contemplative silence.
And what would you contemplate while you were silent?
Oh, just meditate, really.
On what?
I feel like a rest.
On
so.
What? No, I really understand. I do understand your point. I do understand. So if you want to rest from hearing all these words, especially from me because they're fast and bullet-like. So you'd rather have some silence.
Yes, I guess so.
Why do you have to, and I'm not trying to be mean or nasty to you, but I have to ask these questions.
Sure.
Why do you want to come to a group and pay bloody money to be silent?
Well, not altogether, but a little bit of a mixture, like I said. You know, this morning's meditation was lovely. And I got out of bed rather early and drove here to be here for that. It was great. And I suppose my expectation, going back to the same point, was there might be a little bit more, like a retreat, you know, when you're retreating.
I'm saying back to you, no one's cheated you. Unfortunately, no one explained to you that a retreat is a term that's used to refer to all kinds of gatherings in a Buddhist center, including one that I would give, which is a bit of meditation in the morning and a bit at night and maybe something in the middle.
I'm not trying
to be sarcastic or mean to you, darling, but if it is exhausting and tiring, I'm really not being rude to you. Maybe it might be just the best not to stay up. If you've already heard all the teaching in Adelaide, it's quite exhausting for you, then don't stay around and be miserable. I'm really suggesting that. So be relaxed and go back and get your money back. I'm really hearing it, sincerely. I'm sorry to disappoint you, but this is how I do retreats.
Oh, no, I'm loving
even
it all.
Even if I do a retreat, you know, because for me, the main thing is to get the teaching, and then it's up to us individually to go and internalise it in meditation.
Yes. And I like
that's the approach I like to take.
I love the handouts too, because even from Adelaide, I read those handouts after the teachings when
yes.
I got back home.
Yes.
And it was fantastic.
I understand that.
And I'll be doing the same with this.
No, I understand that. So that I understand. Because you did say the word you're exhausted by it.
Not exhausted by it, but I think I've got a bit of a cold, I feel like, more of a bit of a rest. It's wonderful to hear all your information.
I understand that. So maybe, maybe you also might be good to stop and come to one of the sessions, because this is how I do it, I'm sorry.
No, all good.
Even when, like, it was the weekend in Melbourne, we did a retreat, and it was 3 days.
Yes.
And it was on Tara. I did maybe 3 meditations in the whole thing. It's always about things. This is the thing that I feel is important for us to hear, and then we take it away and process for the next year or two.
Yes.
Because this is the nuts and bolts of what we're trying to practice.
Yes.
I understand that people like to have guided meditations and just watching the breath or something. Fantastic, we need to learn that.
Mm.
But all the time I'm mentioning here, we've got to develop and cultivate single point of concentration.
Mm.
And I do know that people, especially Westerners, love being guided in those meditations. But we have to learn to do them ourselves.
Mm.
So I'm really sorry at this point. I am sincerely sorry.
I'll get over it, and I think I want to stay.
I was going to start to meet your mum yesterday, so I'm looking at myself,
but maybe that would make you happy. You know? Did you know she's
the one over there put their hand up before?
No? Yeah. So you came
over from Adelaide? Yes, I was there for the whole week. Do you remember? But
where did you live? In Bendigo.
Oh, that's right. I forgot.
I moved to
Bendigo. From Bendigo to Adelaide. Now she's in Bendigo, you get more. I'll stop and tell
you. It's great. Might see you for another couple of years, so let's
Well, I have other options. You can come on a trek to Lauda, you can come on a cruise in 2020.
Ooh,
you can come to India in Nepal. The order of ways, you have fun to get on a cruise in 2020. And raising money for Lundgren's Cave.
Ooh.
Do you know about that yet?
No.
Oh, I'll tell you about that. Good advertisements. I'm just going to do a cruise. Some people don't like walking up mountains. Some people don't like coming, you know, go to India, sitting, whatever. But they like a cruise. So, you know, I'm great. So I discovered the Princess Life. They do these circumambulations of Australia. Every year, they're one of the most popular cruises. 28 days. So it's I have to put some bunch of money down. I'm using my credit card to get deposit because it's one of the most popular ones. All the cabins get booked out. It's like 2,000 people on these big fat cruises, you know. So we decided we'd do one to to raise money for Mother's Oak Cave up in Monastery up in the mountains. We've been doing a trek up there for the last 2 years. You know, that's another advertisement, my goodness. The last 2 years we're doing another again next year, March, for 15 days. We start in Kathmandu, we take the plane, we go to Nukla, which is where people fly from, and then we walk for 4 days up the mountains, up. Then it's 4,500 meters nearly. And then we spend 6 days up there doing a retreat that'll be the same. So sorry to disappoint you, this is your closing. We do your session as well. So then that raises money for Lauder for that place. Especially when it was harmed in the earthquakes and things. And so we're also, I figured, look, that was always got this special plan to build some special thing up there. So I decided we're going to do a cruise. So in 2020 in March, we need 44 people to make it work. You can come for 28 days, and it's $6,000 US for the 28 days. You have an internal bed in a twin cabin. It's $8,000 US. For a bed in a twin cabin with a window, and it's $10,000 for a bed in a twin cabin with a deck and French doors. You understand? Mm-hmm. So that gives like $700 US of that goes to Mums Over Monastery for his special project. So it's a way to raise money. People love to sort of feel like you have fun and a holiday and raise money for something good so they feel better about it and get a bit of yoga. Because Christina in Sydney, who runs these treks, she's a black girl in karate. She is going to teach yoga and exercises and things, and we'll have meditation as well as teachings. But not as much as we have here. We have more fun as well, swim in the pool and have the dinners and everything, you understand? So it's March 2020.
Yoga and...
What?
What do you do on a cruise? Yoga and...
You do a cruise, and do what cruises do.
Where is it going? Where did that?
Around Australia.
Just around Australia, oh, okay.
Look up the website, Cruise for Laudo, LAWUGO. Cruise for Laudo. You can also look up the Laudo trip and link it to you. That's cheaper. That's $2,500 US.
Are you going to do that?
Yeah. So Cruise for Laudo is one, and then the Laudo trip is the other one, and the pilgrimage to you in Nepal, which we've been doing since 2001, that's the other one, that's in October. That's in this year as well. I forgot the postcard, I'll bring it again.
How did you find the trek?
Very difficult. I don't walk, period, you know. Yeah. I might walk on a flat street in a big city.
Well, when I saw you in India, you were trained in training.
That's right, I know, but it was very difficult.
Yeah.
And it's difficult because it's just simply, you know, because you want to be comfortable.
Yeah, sharp.
My knees let that manage, and my body managed. But then when you get up there, 4,500 meters up, and it's 10 below, 5 below, in these really basic rooms with, you know, yak blankets and things, or straw pillows. This is hard, it's just we love our comfort, you know. But love it, it's amazing. The mountains are amazing, and people love the mountains. And it was booked up, we got it booked up in like a month, 30 people came, you know.
I was on the
way. That's right, exactly, I know. So, yeah, exactly, that's right. So people like it. We're doing another one in March. I might take a helicopter this time.
March next year?
Yeah, March. Laudo Trek. LAWUDO.trek. I think Trek or something. I forget. Just look up Laudo and you'll find it. But the cruise, I think. We didn't even have a couple. We had to see if there's interest. If there's no interest, I have to go cancel because we need 44 people to make it work, you know, financially.
What? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Minimum
44 people. So we want to see if there's any interest. So we're already 32, 34 people have shown interest.
Oh, mm-hmm.
There you go. Well, put your name down on the list. It's really important you get a sense.
Yeah.
So even already some people, I think, especially Americans would love it coming to all this space because it goes Sydney, Melbourne, Burnie, Hobart, Adelaide, a couple of places in West Australia, Broome, Darwin. And because it's going to be not non-profit, duty-free, he's got to zap off to music to New Guinea for a day. And then it goes back. Then it goes Cairns, Brisbane, back to Sydney. 28 days. So yeah, great. So already several people have booked up. Some people have shown interest in a single cabin with a deck, which is $20,000 US for the month. So I'm very happy they can afford it, and they're happy to come for a cruise and get some TCs and have some yoga exercise and give $700 to a good cause. So make everyone happy, isn't it? Okay. Where were we? What question were
you? I had a question.
Right. Yes, we have.
Um, It was about the completion stage for karma to ripen.
The what?
The completion of when you went through the list of the things for karma to ripen, intention, motivation,
oh, yeah.
Action.
Yeah, okay, it's four things. There's four things.
Four, yeah. Sorry.
The first is it has to be the object, the mouse. Second is your mind involved in it, and there's two bits there, intention and motivation. There's more to it all, but this is the simple one. The number two is intention and motivation, so it's two bits. Three is the action, four is the result. Dead mouse, or living mouse. There's more than that, but that's the basic idea. Do you understand?
Yeah, I was just interested in the completion of it.
What do you mean?
Whether it changes because of the object.
What do you mean if it changes because of the object?
Give
me an example.
Well, I was talking to my friend over here, and she was saying that, for instance, it's not a broken vow. If you...
Well, I'm talking about vows, yes. I'm just talking about vow.
Oh, okay.
What she said to you? Who told you? What did you tell me?
I was trying to explain to her the difference between damaging a vow and breaking
a vow. Well, we've got a sucky vow here.
Yeah. We kind of digressed a little bit.
You did, yes. we discussed this morning.
So that answered my question. Thank you.
But I mean, you can extrapolate here because you're talking about an action. Are you suggesting about you giving an example of an action that's not complete? Is that what you're saying? Is that what you're saying? An action that's not complete.
No, I was trying to explain what would constitute breaking a vow of not lying. So that they have taken the vow not to lie.
So what were you telling
them? So lying, as I understand, would be lying about your realization.
That's a major lie, only a major one. There are minor lies.
Yeah, so I was trying to tell her that, let's say I try to deceive her, and I tell her that I'm a realized being, but it would only be considered breaking the vow if she believes me.
So you just give me a recognition, but why are you talking? We didn't discuss that this morning.
Yeah, I know.
You just being clever, tell me all your knowledge. It's all right.
No, we digress.
So all you were doing was describing that an action is not complete if there's some pieces missing. So it's exactly the same here. So if the mouse you wish to kill, the mouse is there, you intend to kill, you have a motivation to hurt it, you do the action, but the mouse doesn't die, that wouldn't be a complete action. That's the same principle. It wouldn't be a complete action. But a complete action really is, it's just getting technical, is simply an action that would create a rebirth. That's all. A complete action is referring to an action that puts various things in place, that's the type of seed that would then bring a type of rebirth. But everything you do brings some kind of result. The tendency to keep doing it, the experience of having it done to us, an environmental result, and many other variations. Because nothing goes astray. Do you understand? Yeah. So her point was in principle correct, but in relation to this it also applies, but not the way she is saying. What else?
I have one other question, which was about the consciousnesses when we were discussing the mind.
Yes.
And you were saying about the sensory consciousness.
Yes.
You discussed eye consciousness and ear consciousness.
Yes.
But we didn't discuss any of the...
No, we just did the example.
Oh, okay.
There's touch consciousness, isn't there? Tactile. And nose, isn't there? And taste, isn't it? The five.
I'm interested if somebody had like a brain type injury. Is that considered to be, and it affected their consciousness for a period of time?
Okay, our mind, our consciousness, using the Buddhist view, and our brain are intimately connected, isn't it?
Yeah.
So the rest of our body. So if you injure some nerves in a certain place on your hand, you won't have tactile. You won't have the experience because the body and the mind are intimately linked. So if the part of our body is injured, then part of our mind can't function, isn't it? If your tongue cuts out, you can't have taste consciousness, can you? If your ear is deaf, you won't have ear consciousness. There's the physical and the mental. So if your brains get scrambled, then your mind can't function properly.
Okay.
That's right, exactly. Exactly that. That's exactly that. The easy demon.
Thank you.
Okay.
We were wondering about our infinite mind.
What?
Our infinite mind.
Our what?
Infinite. Our mind going
into
the
universe.
Yeah. Endless
yeah.
Being.
Your consciousness. Your continuity of consciousness.
Yeah. So when we were thinking about our happiness or not happiness, like our emotion, like joy or anger.
What do you mean, joy or anger?
Like our habitual tendency for joy and anger.
For joy?
Yeah.
So joy is called happiness. Joy is an unbroken
happiness. Happiness.
And that's the name of a feeling. It's a happy, that can be a pleasant feeling. Happiness in Buddhist terms is actually referring to a state of mind.
Mm-hmm.
It's a moment of a pleasant feeling, isn't it? That's
mm-hmm.
happiness.
Mm-hmm.
And there can be degrees of that, can't there? Mm-hmm. Joy, bliss, just pleasant, happy, vaguely happy. That's called happiness.
Mm-hmm.
So that we don't have a tendency for happiness, we have a tendency for anger, we have a tendency for love, we have a capacity for joy and happiness. And Buddha's deal, really, one way of saying the whole of Buddhism, is his method for how to get happy, to get joyful, to get constantly, continuously. He says, we've got that potential. So what's your question? you put joy and anger in the same breath. It's like apples and oranges. So I don't know why you put those two together.
I was trying to think of an example of a positive and negative state.
Oh, okay. So joy is not a positive or negative state of mind.
Right.
Love is a positive state of mind. Compassion is a positive state of mind. Kindness is a positive state of mind. Joy or something or okay. Or describe that anger. So use something else as an example. Love or anger.
Okay, yeah, love and anger. So I get your point to the question of the lady over there about what we experience most of is what we've habituated
well, exactly right, and everything we do.
So given that our mind is beginningless, does it mean that we've over countless
which we'll sounds insane, yeah, come on, we'll just take this as a hypothesis here.
Over countless moments in the past,
that's right.
We've habituated ourselves to love, and over countless moments in the past, we've habituated ourselves to anger.
Yep.
And that.
Then, question?
Okay, yeah. Just clarifying that.
No, what's your question?
Yep.
What's your question? Therefore.
My question was, is that what it is? Is that how we've ended up with. What we've got now. Is that it?
If you practice piano really well, the result is you play piano easily. Is that true? Well, that's an example, that's enough to know. So if you look at yourself and see you have a tendency to be kind, loving, forgiving, generous, therefore happy and joyful, that means you really practice those beautifully. So we can see we might have those. Also, we can see what other habits called being angry, depressed, and jealous, right? Isn't it? So then that means you practice those. So it's Buddhist. All he's saying is, okay, in our culture, we tend to, I think we give equal status to all this stuff. We think an ordinary human being is a bit of anger, a bit of jealousy, a bit of fear, a bit of love, a bit of compassion, a bit of intelligence. We're kind of vague and hope we've got more of the good, but I've got a sense it's a very concrete kind of thing, you know, where we tend to have an assumption that, well, we're born this way, I'm made this way, don't know why, I didn't ask to get born, not my fault, this is how I am. We're sort of stuck with it. We plod along with no plan or no methodology of how to work with those tendencies. We just think we're born this way. Are you hearing my point? We tend to think that, so we stumble along. Some days we get happy, we don't know why. Some days we get miserable, we don't know why. We go down to this despair. And then we pick ourselves up because I'm happy again. And it all just seems to be hit and miss, isn't it? Would you agree with that? So I think we have all these assumptions. It's just the way you're born, and you just kind of do your best, and you stumble along and try not to get too miserable and too bad, too many bad things. But whereas I think it's very fascinating, I understand more things here, but we do know that we, let's say, are born with intellectual capacities. We can be very good at mathematics. We know we might have a tendency to be good at music or tennis. And we know when it comes to activities like that, intellectual learning, in sports, creative learning, we know that we are not stuck with what we're born with. We know you can start off knowing not even 1 + 1, but you can turn into Einstein. We know that, don't we? That means we know we can radically change our minds, and we can turn ourselves into a brilliant musician, a brilliant footballer, a brilliant horticulturist. Do you agree with that? So it's kind of schizophrenic a bit, my way of putting it, from the Buddhist perspective, that we think the stuff that's here, oh well, we're bored, stuck with it. Don't get my point. But the other stuff, we've got this courage, and we've worked for years, and we know we can protect ourselves. It's kind of bizarre that we concretize our emotional stuff and think it's just hit and miss, which is utter tragedy. So the Buddhist view is, it's not set in stone just like anything else is, and we can change it all. That's so, yes, we have to learn. If you're learning to play music, you've got to learn to know your capacity really well, don't you? And to learn to know what you're good at, what you're not good at, what your failings are, what you're not, what you're good. And then you don't get despairing about it. You just keep practicing to rectify the problems so you can become this marvellous musician. And you're so happy to find the problems. You're so happy to discover, you know, when I was studying with my mum, she'd be in the kitchen, and you're playing the piano. Lift your elbow, she'd say. She could tell by the way you're playing that your elbow wasn't right. So she was just because you were skillful. So you're happy to discover my elbow was wrong. I know I'm saying more than you're asking now. I didn't go kill myself. Oh my God, my elbow was wrong again. I don't want to kill myself. But that's how we think about our emotional stuff, because we set it in stone. And then we can't play that piano quite well, we identify, I'm a bad piano player. Well, you can change, baby. Shut up. I'm angry. Yep, you can change. And that's the thing the Buddha says. We've got to know our mind well. And yes, it is in general, if you're not a highly evolved being, you've got to have a tendency to get angry and jealous and depressed and then blame others and then exaggerate it and set it in stone. That's the way ego works. It's just very, and the way Buddhism describes it. So when we have this basic idea, like a revelation, that you're not set in stone, that this is your mind and you need, if you can change it, you better learn to come live with it. Which is why we have to learn, if we're choosing the Buddhist model, taking his very intricate view of what the mind is, how delusions function, so that we can learn, learning what is a weed and what is a herb, you know? You've got to learn to identify it. You have to learn botany first. The weed doesn't reveal itself to you. I'm a weed! You have to learn to know how to identify it and distinguish it from the herbs. That's the job. So yeah, whatever you can see your tendencies are, but you can learn them. You can change. And that's the liberating part. And we get courageous. Mm. And then the really other one is we have to learn to identify more, even though you're only in grade one music, and most of them you can't play piano, but if you go and hear someone else play piano, it gives you the courage to go, wow, I can do that, and you identify with your potential to play piano. That gives you the courage to keep moving. That's so unbelievably important. So in other words, we're a work in progress.
Yeah.
We know when it comes to piano and music and athletics, we'll study for years and work hard for years with enthusiasm and won't give up because we know we can achieve it. But we don't think it when it comes to emotional stuff. We are our own worst enemies when it comes to our emotional stuff. We assume that the chaos that we see there is intrinsic chaos. This is just tragic, you know? You were thinking?
Yeah.
The Buddha view is we can have astonishing control over our own lives, the seeming chaos, which itself should be really encouraging. Wow, you mean I can work with this? Yes. So you need courage. And then when you know you can, you don't mind seeing the rubbish and seeing the chaos and seeing the crazy thoughts and seeing the mad, berserk, demented patterns and things. You won't mind because you know it's not set in stone. So it demands courage and accountability, you know, and ownership of it. And encouragement and enthusiasm.
In relation to assisted dying and karma.
What?
Is it assisted dying or euthanasia?
Yeah. Sorry.
So I'm thinking of that recently it's been legalised or is about to be legalised in Victoria.
To kill somebody?
Yeah. In relation to karma, your karmic actions.
We have to look at that. It's like Justin's question of what about self-defense? Well, this is what about killing your grandma? So it's the same logic. We look at the basics and look into it and analyze what the motivation is. But there's two things, isn't there? The same with the mouse. So let's say it could be just as easy as the mouse. Let's say Justin has his mouse, or Kathy has a mouse in the kitchen. So it's your sister. She wants you to kill her.
She asked you to help you for her or something.
She's asked you what?
She may ask you to help her die because she's suffering.
Okay. Well, just look at it objectively. Just look at it from the Buddhist perspective. Now, I'm not going to give you a definitive answer. So you just take on board these ideas and see what you think, you know? So, okay, we take the Buddhist view. Consciousness, your sister's consciousness will continue after you leave her body. Right. So that already is a huge ask, isn't it? I mean, if you're born up in a Christian world and 99% of people are Christian, everybody buys into the view of going to heaven or hell, is it? So then you just buy into that and it's comfortable for you. But if you're born up in a materialist world, which we mostly are, then that's the view we take for granted, isn't it? That's the view we tend to take as the given one we're brought up with, one we buy into. So then you suddenly hear the Buddhist view that your consciousness will continue, and either you think it's weird and wacko, this religion, or you decide to take it on board. So like I keep saying, my example, I've chosen to take on board, as my working hypothesis, Buddha's deal about the world. So, I haven't proved it yet, I haven't got single point of concentration, therefore I haven't developed clairvoyance, therefore I can't say with certainty from my own experience that that's so. But like, that's any knowledge, isn't it? You can have Einstein telling you about relativity and you can decide to learn from Einstein. You don't know it's really true yet. You can have confidence in Einstein and say that he's proven it, but you can never say it's definitely true until you prove it. So the same here with reincarnation. So I can decide I've got my Einstein called the Dalai Lama and all his mob, the ones we've learned from. They look like they're valid beings. I look at the Buddha's teachings, I look at the Buddha, and you can get some confidence from those people who would say this is how it is, reincarnation. So you have confidence in it, but not certainty from my own experience. So the confidence is helpful. So I'm buying into that hypothesis. So, from the Buddhist perspective, your sister will take another rebirth. And the crucial thing that determines pretty much the karmic seeds that are already in her mind that will determine her future rebirth will be triggered at the time she dies. So it's a really, and it's dealt with in great depth in all the literature, and we'll go into the death process, maybe not now, maybe we will and see. But so at that time, like I was open said, in the book, in the most recent one that's come out, and I happen to edit, I'm so grateful, about how to help people at the time of death. And as I was open said, from the Buddhist perspective, if you're going to help anybody in this life when they need you most, is at the time of death. Why? Is because that's the time the seeds will all come together and be configured naturally, dependent upon the conditions in which you died. That is to say, depending on whether your mind is peaceful or not, then the certain karmic seeds are triggered that will program your sister even before she stops breathing, that will determine the next life. That's the way they talk. So therefore, okay, that's the first point. So there's two things involved. There's you and the karma you create, and there's your sister and the karma she will experience, isn't it? And it's the same for that, no difference. You know? So we, in our world, we very strongly understand, for example, say you have, it was just like Kathy has the set of, or who was it before? I forget, Justin, I can't remember his example. Yeah, Justin has a mouse in his kitchen. One, the mouse is there, a living being. Two, what's in his mind, intention, I will kill the mouse. But in this case, what's your reason, Justin? Compassion. The poor mouse is suffering. It's terrible to suffering. I must kill the mouse to stop its suffering. That's the work, that's the materialist view with certainty, isn't it? The assumption being that your sister's mind and the mouse's mind will stop at the time of death, and therefore their suffering will stop. That's the logic we use, isn't it? That's the materialist view. Well, it happens to be the Buddha had another view, so that's what I'm buying into. So, you know, I'm going to be serious with it then. If we're after this, we attempt to be serious. So, the Buddha's view would be, the third one is, okay, Justin does the action, motivated by compassion, he kills the mouse. Result, dead mouse. And Justin will be relieved and pleased that the mouse is no longer suffering. So he's right, that creature called the mouse, that being called your sister, will no longer be suffering. But if we take the Buddha's view, that the consciousness of your sister or the mouse, dependent on how they were when they died, this is a really precise point, then they would have, their karmic seed would be programmed and they will carry on and take another rebirth. So, we know in ordinary daily life, that if you are not certain, you are not certain about the consequences of a certain action you do, particularly if that action could have dire results for the person you do the action to, if it's a possibility, let's say, oh, I've got a headache, you've got a real compassion for me, and you've got a couple of pills, but you just can't remember which one is on cyanide, you know? Here's my point now. You really do have compassion. That's fantastic for you, isn't it? Compassion is amazing for you. But you're not sure which is cyanide and which is the aspirin. So my sense is you would not play Russian roulette with my health, would you? You wouldn't just give me the cyanide and then realise you gave me the wrong one. Oh, I meant well, Rabin, I'm so sorry, bye. Thank you very much, back off and mind your own business, let me stick with my headache. We accept that as logic, isn't it? So here we use the same logic, of course we're taking the hypothesis that the conscious will continue. And given, and this is the Buddha's view now, based on all their analyses and their experiences, that the time of death said to be very, 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 very fearful for most people, because we have this massive attachment. I'm not even going to talk about that. I want to talk about that now. Go more to the model of the mind, the attachment to these neuroses and how they function. It's very interesting. But let's just say it here. This massive holding on, the wishing not to... One of the functions of attachment, we all know that, is to hold on to something, isn't it?
Mm.
Instinctively, primordially, automatically. So, of course, death is this very dramatic time. The mouse is not going to know, but your sister, let's say, whatever. But if we basically, if the mind is very distressed and grasping and fearful at the time of death, and the mouse, anyways, poor thing, has already been stopped on by you, and it's already suffering, and now you're going to come and kill it. So it's going to be kind of not a very pleasant death. And that would naturally trigger the karmic seeds at the time, even before the mouse stops breathing in your sister, that will cause, as a possibility, it'll cause it to take a lower realm rebirth. So basically, with the mouse, you're putting it from the frying pan into the fire. So then you can be certain.
You might end the physical suffering of the body, but the suffering will continue.
Well, by taking another rebirth, the suffering rebirth. That's the kind of logic of it. So therefore, and see, what's interesting too, because in our materialist world, which is very much coming from stemming back to the Jewish and the Christian one that says that creatures don't have souls and it doesn't matter, it's part of our history. So there's no value for creatures and animals. And do you understand my point? Then the first thing we think of is suffering, we'll kill it. And now we're doing that with humans. So and I think no wonder there's a drama about it, and a lot of conversation. So I think deep down in our bones we know that death is a pretty intense thing. And it's sort of, even though you might say, well, it doesn't matter, if it really is, doesn't matter, if really death is really the end, then we shouldn't have not only fear about dying, you know? Just, oh well, die, pain, and kill yourself, you know? Wouldn't be a big deal. So why is that a huge issue? I think it's kind of interesting in our culture. So there's no concept in Buddhism, of course, because there's a soul there and God and all that stuff. It's because simply it's a practical issue that your conscious will continue. And given that you want a decent rebirth when you die, for yourself, your sister, or your grandma, or your mouse, then if you don't have the wisdom, which implies here the wisdom to know the mouse is mine, the wisdom to know that this is karma in her mind, which is pretty big wisdom, then karma, love your sister. I mean, if she's insisting, it's going to be quite hard for you. But is it really very definite, very clear, is she? She wants that. Or is this maybe discussing it?
Hopefully you have discussions and come to the point of
and she trusts
assisting
you
someone to...
And she trusts you and loves you.
Yeah.
See, that's where, I mean, it's like...
You
the
can.
Buddhist approach is if you can learn to help us to love a person, to give them... I mean, we're all going to die. That's something that we don't like to face, but it's a fact. We're going to die. So when the more we can find it ourselves and have an acceptance of it, and then you take the Buddhist view about karma and you're in charge of the process and you want to make sure you get another decent rebirth, this is a very practical issue, not some religious idea. It's really practical from the Buddhist perspective, you know? Then you do everything in your power to make the mouse happy, to secure, to make it content, fulfilled. And because the Buddha's view talks about subtle consciousness, you know, even when the mouse is in and out of consciousness, including your sister, her subtle mind is functioning. So then you do everything to make them peaceful, including like how we say prayers or mantras, and that can access at a subtle level their consciousness and make them very peaceful and it can help hugely. And then when they die with a peaceful mind. So often, especially with animals, we just go to the default of killing them. But why was that the only option? With our sister now, too, these days. And you know, the Buddha's view is the way they describe the process of death. It's described in terms of these eight stages as this gradual deconstruction of the person. So before you stop breathing, at some point, very, very, naturally, very powerful, intense fear and grasping rises. Very naturally, no matter who you are. So all the more reason to help your beloved sister navigate that and make her feel loved and supported and appraise her, tell her what a good person she is, and help her mind be peaceful and relaxed. This is the most powerful gift you can give. That just comes from loving her, holding on to her, giving her someone to support her. Because death is the physical, it's the sickness is the suffering, but also it's the mental anguish, you know? So it's learning to navigate the physical pain by giving pills and things, but also you can't medicate mental anguish, and that's the main cause of suffering at the time of death, all the fears of what might happen and everything. So sort of love her, don't bully her, I mean, you know what I'm saying, don't bully and give it, no, you shouldn't do that, blah, blah, blah. Love her, support her, praise her, think of it, what a good person she is, praise her for the life she's had, what she's done with herself, what a marvellous person, feeling, making her feel supported by you, that's a huge gift. And you even see it at old people's homes. Even just the sweeping lady can be the one who can be the most loving to the person dying, you know. Mm-hmm. They're making them feel calm, relaxed. Then that's the best thing. Do you understand? Mm-hmm. You can stand on.
Thank you.
Okay. What else? So let's go into the mind now. Let's talk about using the Buddhist model of the mind, describing the different. These just two main ones, the two categories, the so-called neurotic, unhappy, fear-based, distorted, exaggerating, delusional, unhappy states of mind. And then the positive, the virtuous, the valid, the ones that are the source of our happiness and our capacity to be of benefit. This is the big distinction. Like I said before, this is not at all how we talk in modern psychology. We give equal status to all of these, and then they set them in stone. This is what you're born this way, or whatever. Aren't you lucky or something? So, okay. So let's, if we want to first identify the stuff that's making us miserable, this is the first stage. Got to learn to be, you know, identify these. So let's do that. Let's see if we can look into these. Okay. Before I do that, I don't think I want to read from Mummy Issy's book. Just talk about. Talk about. The Buddhist view of the mind is very encouraging about its nature, okay? About its nature. How our mind is. The way they talk is the consciousness, or mind consciousness. The Buddhist view is, from the experience of the great meditators, that. The way they talk about it is it's naturally pure. I mean, that's a bit weird to us, you know. It's naturally clear. The neuroses in it, all our crazy uncontrolled thoughts, all the misery, the confusion, the depression, the jealousy, the stuff I'm going to describe, they are there because of practice, because of habit. But the term they use, they're adventitious. They're not intrinsic. They're not integral to who we are. And this, given the materialist model of the mind, which is based on the brain, this is not that easy to hear, because we're, you know, I mean, and that we can change these and get rid of them. So if you think your mind's your brain, we think, well, we tried that in the 1930s, that's called lobotomy, and it didn't work. So we don't know what to do with that if we are very only considering the brain. So I think we have to at least attempt to think about the cognitive process itself, these thoughts, these feelings, these emotions. And the Buddha's view is that consciousness is clear in its nature. And through utilizing this amazing skill these Indians invented called single point of concentration, which demands incredible effort to get, even a semblance of focus, that when we can begin to even slightly subdue the grosser levels of berserk thoughts and the sensory consciousness, which doesn't even exist as a state in modern psychology, then you won't even believe the joy, the bliss, the clarity. And hear these words literally, please. Not some cosmic gift from superior beings in the sky. But this is called psychology. But we just don't talk like this in modern psychology. So I remember we have a friend, one of our monk friends, who's been meditating for many, many years. He's a scholar, he's a teacher, he's a meditator as well. And I interviewed him in our magazine back in 1995, Mandala magazine. I interviewed him about one of his many retreats. It was in our meditation center in Spain, up in the mountains. I remember that His Holiness Dalai Lama went there in 1982, and I was part of I was the security guard for His Holiness. Lama Yeshe made 10 of us be His Holiness' security guard. And what about Lama made us wear little uniforms and right there then. I was a nun. And these little skirts and little maroon jackets. Very hilarious. But it was really amazing to be there to observe him. Anyway, the point is, the name was sent to you. He said it reminded him of Tibet. He's up way from the mountains out near Granada. Beautiful place. And really, it was reminded of Tibet. Very rugged, little kind of old caves, little kind of cottages and things. But as a retreat centre, basically. So Renee, Venerable Renee, our monk, he meditated there for a couple of years. And I interviewed him about that retreat. And that was the retreat. That was single point of concentration, day and night for 12 hours a day. No talking, no other type of things, not much reading or teaching, only meditating to try to get single point of concentration. Which has really advanced itself. Even to get to the mountains, to be qualified, to be able to even want to do that, and to spend the effort and the energy on doing it and persevering with it. You've already got to be pretty realised. You've already got to be pretty subdued with your crazy body, speech and mind, have not much attachment to things, have no mortgages and cravings for this and that. You'd be already pretty amazing. And he said he knew he wouldn't have been qualified to go off and do that retreat if he hadn't done already his years of practice and purification and studies and teaching beforehand. So it's not that easy a thing to do, you know, to be qualified just to do that. So he said he was there for about 2.5 years, I think, this particular retreat. This is like 24 years ago. He's non-stop since there in different places, and God knows where he's at now. So he said at that point, you know, like in the text they describe this process of concentration, single point of concentration, samadhi in Sanskrit, in terms of 9 stages of cultivation. So he said, maybe, Ravina, I touched upon the 5th of the 9 stages. Which would already be quite advanced, meaning that already he would have subdued, harnessed, steadied with great effort and much practice over that 2.5 years, 8 to 12 hours a day, different sessions. He would have harnessed hugely and subdued the grosser level of perceptuality, the stuff that rages on all day in our head, uncontrolled. So that, again, I keep saying this, not to put something down, but try to compare and try to make it sound like normal psychology, because this sounds cosmic. As soon as anybody talks about meditation in the West, we get all mystical and lose the plot. But that's why I keep referring to something ordinary. It happens to be these ingenious Indians coming to the Buddha and carry on since then for several thousand years. This technique is there, extant, real, being used all the time and being accomplished. Right. So he would have subdued, and he would therefore would have subdued his conception, his sensory consciousness, his sensory consciousness. So we subdue our sensory consciousness every time we go to sleep, right? But we're unconscious conceptually, aren't we? We have these weird dreams. We go to the subconscious. We have no control, and it can be very nice dreams, can be very weird dreams. We know that. We assume that's just the way that is. So here, these great beings who learned this technique can learn to go to a more subtle level of consciousness that can subdue the sensory level and the grosser conceptual, but not go to sleep. But learn to access their more subtle level so they can be super conscious. Just hear these words literally. So he said, this is my point here. He said, and this is my point to you with this word joy. He said, and I forget the words exactly, there's no question, the joy, peace, whatever word you like, joy, peace, calm, bliss, loving Yeshi in here when he describes the qualities you'll have when you've achieved all of the concentration, all the way to the night stage, ecstasy, rapture. Please hear this word literally. It's weird to us. He said the joy he experienced was so superior to any joy he'd ever experienced through his senses. So this, of course it sounds useful to us, but this is the Buddhist point. That's just an example, just to show the potential of our minds. So when we've even, to some degree, even temporarily, subdued the grosser level of the chaos and the conceptual stories and the sensory, we can and learn to access these more subtle levels, then the mind is naturally joyful, naturally peaceful, naturally blissful, naturally clear. And then you retain that as you really progress in this concentration. It's not the end result, you've got way more work to do. But you can retain this extraordinary capacity. Like what Lama Yeshe says in here, when you've got this single point of concentration, when you're out of meditation, one of the key characteristics is that you have absolute and effortless control over every tiny thought. Now, there's no equivalent even remotely like this. And even if we do think about meditation, and people can have amazing visions and special experiences, it's always temporary. You go back to being normal again. But this is the perfection of this technique, that you can have it and you retain it in your daily life. You have effortless control over every single tiny thought. You've still not got way to go before you get rid of all the delusions. But you've got such effort and control, it's nothing to work on your mind. You would never have mental breakdowns. You would never go up and down like a yo-yo. This is inconceivable to us. You'd need very little sleep. Your body would be like a feather. You'd be always compassionate and wise because you've so got so much equanimity. You'd also be extremely joyful. You don't need to have eat cake and have sex to get joy. And that's the big thing here, the Buddha's view about suffering. The way we are caught up in our bodies and our world and our mind in this, we're embodied beings, basically, aren't we? That, you know, we're driven because of this by the sensory experiences. We're driven. We determine our entire life in terms of our sensory experiences. Practically, you know, not quite, we know. But it's huge. So then when you've got this concentration, even to some degree, you're more controlled, you're more aware of all your thoughts before they arise as emotion, you don't even get thrown by them. You can really navigate life in the most extraordinary way. This is not, got way more to go than we can do, but even this alone is extraordinary. You know? So the way they say it about the mind, it's like a mirror. They use the analogy of it's a mirror. It's very weird, we don't talk this way. But your consciousness, it cognizes whatever exists out there. So like I said before, you know, how if we are full of anger and attachment and fears and dramas and whatever, that's like polluting the mirror or cracking the mirror. So then whatever is reflected back, that's how they talk, that whatever's out there is reflected back to our mind. Whatever the world is out there, it appears back to us. People, things, events, this one, war, lovely, beautiful, ugly, this, the whole world is, and that's how a very strong feeling is that I'm here and the world's out there, isn't it? That's how we feel. So that everything out there is reflected back to us, as I said before, according to what's in the mind, which is the mirror, if you like. So if my mind, even a simple example, like a body of water that's completely still, the tree on the bank of the river is reflected accurately, isn't it? I mean, it's a simple analogy. But if the water's turbulent, the tree will look really ridiculous. Well, that's our mind. Right now, our mind is full of anger. You know what people are like when they're full of anger. They're seeing ugliness everywhere, finding fault everywhere. Everything appears back as ugly and revolting. If a person is loving, I just saw an Italian a couple of nights ago. Did anybody see that? That amazing, what's that church in King's Cross?
Wayside
Chapel, that beautiful guy who's now the boss of it.
Yeah.
You just have to look at his face, he looked like an angel in human form, didn't he? This eye, this bliss, this joy, this amazing, was he Indian or something, wasn't he?
Sri Lanka,
that's right. He's an astonishing being, like he's like, but just full of joy, full of love. He wanted to live in the most disgusting suburb with the poorest people. He started a community centre. He's the most humble. You can't imagine this person. So you can say for sure he has practiced humility. You can tell he's practiced giving up anger. He's practiced love, practiced compassion. He was the embodiment of it. So, of course, in our culture, he kind of just gets born like that. It's like pot luck, isn't it? A little nice person comes out of the mother's womb. Well, he's the fruit of his own past virtue. And you can look at his face, you can tell, wasn't it? It was astonishing. I couldn't believe this person, you know, full of love and kindness and compassion. So you could say whatever was reflected back to his mind was extraordinary. And just all it did was increase his compassion, increase his empathy, and increase his own happiness. He was joyful all the time. So the logic we have is if the world is full of suffering, how can you be happy? You've got to go kick yourself. He could see the suffering world, but he was always joyful because he saw the humanity everywhere. He saw humanity, he saw the ugliness, he saw the war, but he sees humanity. And I was talking my way of saying it. So he's this extraordinary being. So his mirror, because that was really clear, you know, his mind is pure and clear, full of love, compassion, therefore joyful naturally. So what Buddha is saying is this. Our mind has got this amazing potential to be blissful, clear, wise, joyful, and that the virtuous qualities, love, compassion, kindness, generosity, intelligence, have the nature of being joyful, happy, joyful. The other ones, attachment, jealousy, they are a nightmare. So we aren't we fortunate we can access some of our virtue? Look at some poor peanuts on this planet who can only access their insanity. The pedophiles, the monsters, the mean people, the ugly ones, the dreadful politicians, the liars, the thieves, the warmongers, the murderers. I mean, look at the human planet. Can you imagine what the period back to their mind reflected in their insanity, which are their qualities from their habit in the past? So this is why the Buddhist view would say in the wisdom wing, when you really begin to become familiar with your own pathetic evil habits, look at our pathetic habits. Well, I eat a bit too much cake sometimes and get a bit depressed or being mean to the boyfriend. But you imagine, like one of my friends on death row in Kentucky, he's a Buddhist, wonderful man, getting close to his death date. I'm ready for that electric jolt, he said, recently, or a while ago. So there's one of his friends on death row, and I visited them. This other guy, I can't think of his name, but as Mitch, my Buddhist friend, said, Rabina, he thinks of torture all the time. So the Buddhist view is that your karma, you get born with your tendencies. So can you imagine being, just, this is where you've got to have compassion for yourself first. Can you imagine being born with the tendency to kill all the time? I remember reading one of those serial killers years ago in America. Since he was tiny, he said, he was compelled to torture the creatures. He got pleasure from torturing the creatures. His mummy hadn't taught him this. Just like the other little boy was crying in compassion for the lice. So in our world, it's just like potluck. You're born as a murderer, you're born as a compassionate person. But no, the Buddha says you're born with what you practice. So when you begin to get in touch with your own mind, and I haven't gone into details about describing these yet, I want to, I will, I'll get to it, I promise. Then you start to realize these are why you are suffering. You, instead of feeling guilty, beating yourself up, blaming your mother for it, or whatever, you want to become familiar with these unhappy states of mind, these conceptual stories. You want to recognize your mother's virtuous conceptual stories and grow those as antidotes to the other stuff, and you identify with this marvelous potential for clarity and joy and bliss, knowing, just like you identify with your marvelous potential every time you see Federer play tennis and you're only in grade one tennis, it gives you encouragement. But so you see the yogis, you see the ones we talk about, as you see that they're examples, like, you know, like I think of, so even that guy, or Dalai Lama, or whatever, who are living examples of the proof of the pudding, the proof of the pudding of this practice. So it gives you courage. Wow, I can do that too. So then you have this very different attitude towards your nonsense, and you want to investigate it. You want to delve into it. You want to identify it. You want to listen to these conceptual stories so you can see the ones that are causing you pain. You don't exaggerate them. You realize how they cause so much suffering, and it's like you have compassion for yourself due to your own ridiculous past habits and your own stupidity. You practice this dog nonsense, but you now know you can change. So even hearing about what you can accomplish in these marvelous techniques, it gives you courage and something to identify with, rather than, well, you're all born this way, cross your fingers and hope for the best. It's powerful, isn't it? So then, when you're brave enough, you realize, you look at the rest of the world, oh my God, they're all in the same boat. And then you start to think, I'm all with this pathetic habit, you don't want to be mean and get depressed and eat too much cake and whatever. Then can you imagine wanting to jump on the girls all day? Could you imagine, like my friend on death row, wanting to torture? And this is where the thoughts, we all know our thoughts are uncontrolled, our negative ones. We know that. We can't harness them. We know they're uncontrolled. So could you imagine having uncontrolled thoughts to rape people? Could you imagine having uncontrolled thoughts to kill people? Could you imagine having uncontrolled thoughts to torture people? And because of the habit, you're compelled to do it. When you really know your mind like this, you can then, if you're brave enough, you can have compassion for that. But that's not how we talk in our culture. Especially when they've harmed us. So this is a huge one. So you've got to do the work on your own mind first. And when you own them, your own habits, you have the courage to own them, but they're not set in stone. And then you have the courage to own your good ones, which are our saving grace, which we can utilize and use to learn to slowly reconfigure this mind. So let's look at the three main neuroses, unhappy states of mind, delusions, the three misconceptions, the three The Buddha would call them the three poisons. Well, we could call them the three toxic emotions. That's a term we use in our modern psychology. It's great. Toxic emotion. Buddha has identified 84,000. Come down to three, okay? If you understand these three, and even two of them, you really have a deep understanding of your own mind and of other people's minds. So the three are called, there's like a hierarchy of them. There's a hierarchical relationship between them. The root one, this is how Buddha talks, the root delusion, the root neurosis, the root one, primordially deep. So primordially deep, we don't have a label for it, you know. It's total feeling. Completely instinctive. And this, they call this colloquial term for this one, is ego grasping. Its natural tendency is like, it's fear-based, totally a fear-based, panic-stricken, neurotic sense of the separate, concrete me-ness, deep in our bones. So that's driving this next one. The next one is its natural main voice, and that's this one called attachment. And then the third one, when attachment is thwarted, aversion. We'll discuss these two, attachment and aversion. It's dealt with in great depth in the Buddhist literature, and you learn it first, like anything, you learn the definition, and then you have to study it, and observe it, and look at it, and unpack it. Mama used to say, I can tell you about attachment for one year. You'll never begin to understand it until you start looking deeply inside, in a very coherent, disciplined way. So effectively, the Four Noble Truths is teaching the Buddha Gate. This is the main source of our suffering in day-to-day life. So to get clear, then we better get clear the definition, because this is not the way we use the word attachment in our culture. It's like almost an equivalent of, we use a different definition completely, as a good quality, close to your friends, or she's really attached to her family. That's fine. The word the Buddha's using has got a very different definition. It's only heading negative for a start. It's the main voice of this ego grasping. So it's multifaceted, okay? The deepest energy of it, we're born with this, what's the point, you know, from past practice of it. The deepest energy of it is a feeling, a deep feeling of dissatisfaction. Aching, constant feeling, I haven't got enough, I don't do enough, I haven't achieved enough, whatever I have achieved is not enough, how much I've got is not enough, the way I look is not enough, when I change the shape of my body is not enough, how much you tell me you love me is not enough, what I accomplish is not enough. It's the default energetic level of this, and a symptom of this attachment. And we can see on the planet, some of them have much more suffering than others. This is it's like this vampire-like hunger, this dissatisfaction. Then it gives rise to the next level of attachment. Naturally, if you're feeling dissatisfied, you haven't got enough, haven't got enough, haven't done enough, haven't achieved enough, it gives rise to the next level of this kind of emotional hunger. This constant kind of yearning, this craving, this hankering after something that sucks, that when I get it, it will fill up the gaping hole and satisfy the dissatisfaction. So this is a level we can recognize quite easily. Attachment to the objects of the senses. This is not a moralistic teaching. This is technical and practical. It's very interesting. So this is constant feeling I haven't got enough. So naturally, you hanker after something. This is the attachment's job. And then it focuses in on finding an object of the senses. So in one case, it might be food for somebody, it might be bodies, it might be killing for someone else, depending on your karmic tendencies. It might be jumping on little girls for some pedophile. And I'm using extreme examples and mild examples because the disease is the same. It's called attachment. So then depending on how severe it is for you and how strong the karmic habit, then that's the conditions that determine that. So this hunger, then what it does is attacking, looking for the object, and then gets the object, and then manipulates to get it, controls to get it, control freak, that's attachment's job, then this is the key function that it has, it gets us stuck in it, completely exaggerates, attachment completely exaggerates the deliciousness of the object, the power of the object to make me happy. So as a person, we can see how all-consuming it is, you know. The chocolate cake is the same principle. We know this, it's evident. There's a cat on the chocolate cake, the dissatisfaction. Oh, what do I have? Oh, cake. Oh, the little light bulb goes on, then you get up and you go to get it, and then you control to get it, you manipulate, you get it, and then the expectation is all part of attachment too. This massive expectation, this massive anticipation, and then eventually you get it, and of course with a piece of cake, when you see it with the eyes, we know this, we do know this, our senses. Eye consciousness will see that shape and colour. But we know it will appear to be the most delicious thing you've ever seen. This is completely instinctive. We don't even stop to analyse it. We know it looks completely divine. So, of course, the anticipation is massive to get it into this hole. We don't make a mistake and put it in the wrong hole. We're programmed. We know which hole to put it in. So, then you put the cake in, and of course, this is what happens now. This is where it's a bit technical, but it's really important to understand. To summarise attachment, to summarise its job, it's this part of us that's happening every second, like a motor that runs the show, it's there all the time. But leave all our good stuff. We're not discussing the good stuff, we're discussing the wrong stuff. So this attachment, it's essentially this junkie in us that can only bear or cope with the nice things. It's got to get the nice things. And when it's really intense, it's got another way to put it, and it's the same for all of us, another way to put it is attachment is this junkie that wants to get what I want every second. So then when it's really intense attachment, an intense past habit to harm sentient beings. Cake doesn't mind if you shove six pieces in. Sentient beings do. So that's what attachment is really powerful, that caused this massive hungriness due to past habit to then harm sentient beings. That's when it's so destructive. So even in ordinary relationships, forget if you're a pedophile, I purposely use extreme examples. But ordinary attachment, in an ordinary relationship, from a lover's friend, you know. The hunger in me is enormous. There's an assumption in attachment that I'm nothing. Unless I have Fred. I am nothing unless I get cake. I am nothing unless I get this, and this. So there's a sense of a separate self that's so lonely and bereft. That's really what attachment's coming from. So there's always this feeling of not having enough, feeling of not getting enough. Always wanting something more. So it's cake, we keep chucking the cake in, anticipating, hoping, praying for, begging, waiting for happiness to come. But all Buddha's saying is, the more we analyse this process, the tragedy is, you don't get happiness. You get some pleasure. Joy does come. There's no doubt that your stomach's empty and all the conditions are together, and the delicious cake made well goes into the mouth, but it meets the senses, it meets the tongue and everything else, it definitely triggers a pleasant feeling. Guaranteed. So in a way, attachment's job isn't even attachment to the cake. It's attachment to the pleasant feeling that contact with the object triggers. But the Buddha says, it is pleasure, but it won't last, and it's really contaminated. Because look at all the hard work just to trigger a moment of pleasure. You've got to manipulate, you've got to get money, you've got to have things, you've got to get the cake, you've got to put it in, and suddenly before you know it, after the third piece, you're already, the pleasure has gone, and it's downhill to feeling disgusting. And now you want to vomit. This is the analysis we have to do to try and distinguish the attachment and the joy that comes. Has got nothing to do with attachment. That's why it's interesting why you use that word. Joy is in the third category. Happiness is in the third category. It's merely a feeling. It's neither good nor bad. In the sense of virtuous and non-virtuous. It's quite a technical understanding, but it's different from how we talk. But pleasure is what we find in what? A pleasant feeling. So you could argue, well, Buddha says, you know what, guys, I've got a method.
To get happiness,
to get pleasure, to get joy. Okay, so we think, this is the point now, deep in samsara, this is called samsara, Buddha says it's a philosophy we have deep in our brains, deep in our bones, we've been practicing for eons. And this is the way the samsaric philosophy acts out in our lives, we're driven by attachments to the boss. So what we feel happiness is in the ordinary world is what you get when attachment gets what it wants. Buddha says he's found a method, and he says no. Pleasure, joy, happiness are what you get when you give up attachment. It's what's left in the mind. So this is why even the meditator example, Renee's example, even not even completed in this technique, but a really powerful realized being is practicing his life. But even, in other words, even temporary respite from anger, depression, anxiety, fears, drama, craving, worries, even a temporary respite from those equals that much pleasure, that much joy, that much contentment. And any meditator you talk to in the literature, you read it, that joy, that bliss that you would experience, and they use those words literally, would be infinitely peaceful, infinitely calm, not frantic, which is how we think about pleasure. Frantic and desperate, you know, because it's driven by attachment. It's, in other words, attachment's a junkie mind. Attachment is being a junkie. And we're all junkies, Buddha says, it's just a question of degree. That's all. That's all. So the junk, the person who wants to jump on the girls all day, they've got an intense attachment to what we label so-called sexual activity that comes along with all the other manipulating and controlling and harmful other negative qualities that you need to make it give its object every time. Attachment is a honey-covered razor blade. It can look very benign. If I'm in love with bread, it means I'm mainly attached in the beginning. It looks completely divine, but this neediness in me has been hugely satisfied temporarily. So of course I then have love for him. Love is in the second heading. Love is a virtue. Love is valid. Love is may he be happy. I want him to be happy. And of course I want him to be happy. But that love will turn off like a tap and disappear the second he stops doing what my attachment wants. So the attachment we've got is like a honey-covered razor blade. But we, in our culture, we don't even distinguish between attachment, which is this little monster in us, this hungry, needy little person to get what I want every millisecond, which is the pleasure feelings, and the more that hunger is there, the more you will brutalize other beings to get what you want. It's so desperate. It's so frantic. So aren't we lucky that we have attachment for the pathetic old cake, not to murder people and torture people and kill people and rape people? Aren't we fortunate? How incredible. So yeah, lock them up. Of course, lock them up. When you understand it yourself, you'll understand other people. And that's why compassion in Buddhism is way not the way we think about it. When we think of compassion in the West, we only have compassion for innocent victims. And to that degree, we have to hate the person who harmed them. The more we are a victim, the more we have to find someone to blame. Whereas the view of compassion in Buddhism, we're all in the same boat, Buddha says. We are, every one of us, in the same boat. Every one of us had countless past lives. There's no harm we haven't done to others. There's no good quality we haven't got and haven't done. So we just keep circling around, meeting each other, punching and being punched, punching and being punched, kissing and being kissed, until we start doing something about it. That's a very different view. I really can see that. So the starting point is to know our own mind and begin to have some compassion for ourselves. And know we've got this marvelous potential. Even just forget the long-term potential, but the potential to even be able to some degree, learn to harness our crazy energy and be in control of it, and learn to become more joyful, more fulfilled, more content, and therefore more kind, more compassionate. It's a gradual, ongoing. It's like a work in progress, you know, turning ourselves into these marvelous people. And the key to it, in terms of the mind, is understanding this particular model, because it's unique to the Buddha, identifying these in our own mind, and slowly, slowly changing. Not overnight, no way. So attachment, then okay. It's a junkie that only wants what I want 24 hours a day. And of course, the stronger it is, like my poor friend on death row, thinking about torture all the time. Look at academic habits. We think about food all the time. One of the signs of attachment is you think about it when it's not there. We live in attachment, it's obvious. Frantically thinking, even in our minds, searching for something to think about to make us feel better, because we're always feeling bereft, always feeling empty, always feeling dissatisfied. So attachment is primordial junkie in silence. And the millisecond it doesn't get what it wants, panic attack. That's aversion. So there's attachment and aversion. These words are so cute, it's embarrassing. But the understanding of them in Buddhist psychology is profound. So attachment is the motive that runs the show. Always searching, always looking. Underneath our kindness, our love, our compassion, our intelligence. They're all there working away. This stuff's polluting it. Underneath it's there, constantly driving. And there our saving grace. So we've got to become familiar with this stuff that's polluting the goodness. Then we can grow the goodness even more when we understand this stuff. So the millisecond attachment doesn't get what it wants. That instantaneously turns into aversion. So basically attachment is, that's lovely, you go towards it. Aversion is, oh no, that's horrible, I don't want that. So this has a whole spectrum of responses. Aversion. The usual, obvious, gross, volatile expression of aversion is what we call anger. The millisecond you're attached to the thing it wants, freak out. Shout, yell, kick, scream, argue. It's really an evident one. We can see it on the planet. Whether you're 2 years old or 92, we can see it in some people. Absolutely spontaneous. And then you've got the milder versions of it. We never pay attention to these because they're not serious. Irritated. Annoyed, frustrated, upset. We do that, we say that 20 times a day. Why? The moment your attachment doesn't get anything to be perfect, because attachment is a junkie that wants everything to be perfect and lovely and nice, which is what I want every second. It's what I want every second. Get its own way every second. The second it doesn't, you get annoyed, irritated, frustrated, upset. These are all polite words for mild anger. And then the response when attachment doesn't get what it wants. Then you've got more internalized, more subtle, depression and despair. There's a spectrum between these. And they're all the same. They're based on aversion, and aversion is the response when attachment doesn't get what it wants. And they are both the result of the deepest one, the misconception about the self in the first place. A sense of a separate, bereft, nothing. Me. That's the irony of ego. It's like I'm nothing. And it's panic stricken. And fear is the nature of all of these delusions. Fear is their nature. So as we progress spiritually and become more joyful and more loving and compassionate, you do not have fear. You have fearlessness and confidence and courage and pleasure and delight and love and compassion. Naturally. Naturally. Nothing will throw you. This is how Buddha talks. This is Buddhist psychology. So even getting some semblance of understanding of this. Forget getting concentration. Forget going to the mountains. Forget giving up sex, drugs, and rock and roll and becoming whatever. Forget even the most elaborate level of it. Even some semblance of practice at this, you know. You can already learn to navigate life with a more, it's like you become more adult. And I don't mean mean about this, but these are the symptoms of like an infant, of a non-adult. We're like, all like, the more attachment there is, the more like we're really greedy little vampires who are completely self-centered. In its nature, it's self-centered. So the more we can lessen that and lessen the aversion and with courage and practice, the more we can navigate and therefore won't have mental breakdowns when things go wrong. You're braver in the face of things going wrong because things will go wrong. That's the nature of life. So it's a method of learning to grow up, becoming our own marvellous self, becoming more in touch with ourselves, growing our own fantastic potential, our own qualities, seeing our own mind more clearly, having confidence in its potential. That's the result of controlling our body, speech and mind. Abide by the law of the karma, don't kill, don't lie, don't steal, don't jump on every time. And that's the thing about strong attachment. It's why you have to harness it. Every time you follow your cravings and eat the cake, you don't get happiness. As my mother used to say, it's profound, Buddha totally agrees. The more you get, the more you want. It's profound. That's exactly the disease of attachment. We all know that with the junkie mind. The more you get the object, you don't get happiness. You increase your craving for more until eventually you destroy it. This is attachment. So that's why the first level of practice is use your mind first, mainly to harness the servants of the mind, harness your body and your speech, which demands discipline, demands control, it demands self-respect, not just suffocating yourself, not just suppressing, but disciplined control over your body and speech for your own sake. That already is huge. Then you've got the space to start going more deep into your mind, which is the source of the problem, and unpack and unravel that. Any questions, people? Yeah.
One second.
Is there an occasion where aversion can then develop back into attachment?
Say it again.
Is there an example where aversion can actually then develop into attachment?
Can what?
Aversion.
Yeah.
So we've been using examples of having attachment to, say, chocolate cake. You desire it, you want it, you have a piece, you enjoy it, you have that pleasant sensation.
Yeah.
If you don't sit and realise that's transitory,
yeah.
And you want more and you eat more and you consequently then have an aversion to it because you feel sick.
Well, that's what happens, obviously. Or you just have aversion to too many pieces.
Yeah. Can it then flip back the other way? Can you have aversion to something and over time, however you react to that, can you then...
The answer is yes, but it's happening every second. This is what's so interesting. You know, food's a good, simple example, we've all got that one. Pretty much, I know hardly met a person who's not attached to food. Do you understand what I'm saying? Hardly a person. We might not all be attached to jumping on little girls, or killing, or lying, or torturing, but we all love our food. So, okay. But this is the point. This is what the suffering is. So in the beginning, your stomach's empty, all the conditions are perfect, the cake is divine, you're feeling happy, and you put it in the mouth and it's just joy. It's such joyous treat, isn't it? And we're not satisfied. We're not satisfied with that amount of joy. We want more. So even before you finish the mouthful, there's another mouthful in, isn't it? And it's the anticipation process. Oh, that was so divine, I want more of it. I want more joy. But we all know, so interesting point. Buddha's sort of saying there's nothing wrong with wanting joy. It's perfect. But what he's saying is, we make the mistake of thinking the cake will bring it. So basically, it's really true. The only way we know how to trigger pleasant feelings is by having sense objects, isn't it? Pretty much. If we have really good fantasies, we can do it. I mean, people can have extreme fantasies in their mind living in their heads, isn't it? I mean, including killing and raping people can live in their heads and you can trigger some experiences. But we see the usual way we are these embodied people, having the five senses. The only way we know how to trigger pleasant feelings is get an object of the senses. So we know that, isn't it? So it's the only way we know. But it's a judgy mind, so it's not happy with that moment of joy. You take that piece of joy, because it's always the first apple that's the best. You take this and do this, and let me just enjoy this and put no more cake. No way! Because we're junkies, we have to do it again, because we want more joy, which is fine to want more joy. But what we don't realise is the cake won't bring joy. It's downhill from the first one. And that's the point. So the second mouthful, it's not as good as the first. The joy is already diminishing. And this is why Buddha calls, I'm jumping ahead of it here, in the Four Noble Truths. We'll go into it in a second. But we know that what happens is, you have the next mouthful, wanting that same joy, or even more joy, but it's already diminished. And then you're getting a bit anxious by now, so you have a third piece, just in case it's going to bring you, it might happen, so you keep having it, but the joy keeps diminishing, and what takes over inexorably is unjoy, unpleasant, full stomach. And by the fourth piece, look how it looks. Disgusting. And look how you feel. And then you get guilty, then you get constipation, then you get acid reflux. Right? So the attachment, the Buddhist point is attachment inexorably, if you keep having the object, turns into aversion. Right there. But tomorrow, I'll completely forget the acid reflux. I'll completely forget how disgusting the cake looked after four pieces. I'll completely forget the constipation. Mm-hmm. And I'll just pray for the joy again. So we're as blind as bats, basically. If we had enough wisdom and enough self-respect, we'd realize this after the first experience of cake. But we don't. That's the suffering. So it turns into aversion every time. In other words, this sounds so absurd. The Buddha says, "God, use logic." We believe this institute. I mean, forget the cake. Think of the best sex in the universe. You can't surpass the joy and the pleasure of saving contact with a human being. Let's say blah blah blah. And I'm not talking about love and empathy and closeness. They are the virtues. Put those aside if you can. It's hard to, because we have the joy, you know, the pleasure, along with the love and the compassion for a person that is so sublime, you know. But it was mainly only attachment. The Buddha says this: "Hey guys, have you not noticed that the more you have, like my mother would say, the more you, okay, Buddha say, the more you get, the less pleasure." The more you get that, okay, now I'm going to be gross here, but trying to my point. Think of the most divine person in the universe, only been in love once, and had the best experience you've ever had. So imagine, I have to say it this way, imagine this incredible bliss from that wonderful union, you have the joy, the wonderful blah. Then you do it again, you have sex again. You don't go to sleep and get hungry again. You keep having sex. And then you keep having sex. No sleeping, but you have it again, and you have sex again, and you have sex again. What will be the result eventually? What would be the result? What? What? What?
So graphic, I said ouch.
Well, way more than that. You'd be absolutely revolted and disgusted, and you'd die of exhaustion, and you'd be totally repulsed. You'd be sore, you'd be brutalized, you'd be like, you'd be absolutely violently sick and repulsed. Is this not logic? So the cake, the same. If you kept eating cake, now that means stop and get hungry again, but keep eating it, you would vomit and die. Well, it happens to be that it's easier to do with heroin. Heroin is just much more dramatic. A way bit too much and you'll die. Well, you've got to work harder to do by the cake, and you've got to work harder by having sex, but it's the same logic. I know this sounds like ridiculous, but we don't want to hear this because we're junkies. And the only way we know how to trigger any pleasant feelings is by a little bit of cake every now and again, and a boy every now and again, and a handbag every now and again. But then it soon turns into pain. This is not being fundamentalist. This is logic. We don't want to know about it. It's too painful to hear it. So then you say, well, what is the cause of happiness then? This is what Buddha's saying. What is the cause of happiness? He says, give up attachment and anger and delusions. And jealousy, and pride, and low self-esteem, and eventually ego grasping. Then you have cut the root of all suffering. Your mind is sublime and blissful and radiant and perfect and loving and compassionate and can never go back to the misery again. This is what he means by the word nirvana. And it's not some place like heaven. It's a psychological state, and it's the potential of every single mind, Buddha says. And it's just hard work. That's how he talks. Are we communicating?
Yeah.
Any other questions in the room? Yeah. Sweetie Pie? Yes.
I'm still here, Ben. There was a very interesting comparison that you gave, or dichotomy of attachment, where when you're attached and you've got that craving and it turns into aversion.
Yeah.
But then, when you go on the other side, for non-attachment, you go into experience all the things that attachment drives you to, but even better.
I don't get it.
You don't get it?
No. Oh. Right. Give an example. What's non-attachment? You have to give me that description of non-attachment. What do you mean by that?
Non-attachment is
where you don't suffer for something that you want. So a feeling.
Okay. So what you're saying is you don't have attachment to a certain object.
Yes.
You're not craving it and hungry for it.
Right.
Okay, so good. So then what happens then?
So then because you don't have the attachment or the craving,
uh-huh.
you'll get even a better experience from living because you don't have that attachment.
Yeah, another way of saying what I said before, we give up attachment.
Yes.
You're more happy, you're more content, more fulfilled. That's right.
Yes.
That's the point. Yes. That's exactly what Buddha's saying.
And you have even more happiness and more contentment.
That's what Buddha's saying. That's his point.
So, you know...
That's his method to get happiness. He said, more got the potential to be blissfully joyful and happy. He said, this is his method for giving up suffering. This is the main cause of suffering, so you give it up, you get happy. That's what he's saying. That's what I was just saying before.
Mm. I think that's beautiful. I love it.
It's encouraging.
It's encouraging, and I hope to experience it more.
There you go, that's right. Exactly.
So I'll stay further.
Hold on, happy. We'll read a bit of Lama. We'll do little meditations here and there. You know, just, we'll do that. So who else wants to ask a question? Nobody else?
Would we just like to know an opinion?
Part of the tea as well. It's 4 o'clock.
Mm-hmm. Oh, do we want a break? Sorry.
Mm-hmm. In a minute, go on.
Oh. Okay.
Go, darling.
Okay, it's just it's actually just asking for a point of view that relates to contemporary zeitgeist or whatever you want to call it.
Okay.
Okay, so going back to the beginninglessness of time, or beginninglessness of cause and effect, I love that because I can appreciate it, but I don't realise it, I must say. I don't realise it, I don't live that way, but I love it because it's non-linear, and I think
it's totally linear.
Oh, you get it linear.
It is linear. Of course it's linear. Linear means, I mean, an effect comes after a cause. An effect is the result of a cause. So a cause comes before an effect, doesn't it?
Just yeah, but you can't find language. The beginning of that cause. Isn't that linear?
No, that's not what being said. No, no, you're completely misunderstood.
Okay, I'm glad I brought
it up. Completely misunderstood. Sorry. No. That's not what's being said. Buddha's saying anything that exists at this second in time has a cause. So, about 40 trillion years ago, whatever existed at that time had a cause. So it is only linear. What else is it? It's an ordinary conventional, you know,
there's no first cause.
That's
my
point.
Yeah, so that's my point. If there's no first cause, how can that not be linear?
Oh, no, darling, you're still not misunderstanding it.
Oh, okay.
You seem to want a first cause. I think there is one there, but you just kind of can't find it.
Probably. But I'm saying I'm delighted that there isn't a first cause.
What does it imply to you?
It implies to me that things are not so linear like beginning and end.
But linear doesn't mean beginning and end. They're two different concepts.
Oh, I think linear does. Oh.
Linear means straight. Linear means this way. And beginning and end is another discussion.
Except that a definition of a line is the shortest distance between two points.
Yeah.
It's
not linear. What is it?
Spiral.
Oh, it's rubbish. I mean, and just probably calling it circular.
A centimetre doesn't exist if it doesn't have a reference point.
What does that mean? Is what?
A unit of distance doesn't exist if it doesn't have a start point. So, how do we know it's linear or cyclic or spiralic or not?
I mean, I just think we just want to use it. Here we're discussing conventional reality from the Buddhist perspective of how Buddhism talks. Conventional reality. So forget the label linear then.
Yeah.
I don't care what you call it. But do we agree in ordinary world, conventional universe, conventional reality, that if we say cause and effect, an effect is the result of a cause, and it comes after, and the cause comes first. Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
That's all. That's enough. That's it. Just call it circular, you know what I mean? Certain ways, it's true what you said in another way to me, but that's okay. But don't forget linear, that's not the point. And get the main point of it. Cancel the conversation. It's completely boring. Never mind. But go on, I'm glad you like it.
That's all right. All right, well then I just have a general question.
Yeah.
At the moment, we're living in a time where we... we've got the extremism of protectionism in extreme kind of leaders, and so we're living in a time where there's a lot of holding on and there's a lot of grasping, and then on the other side there's a big push for a non-binary sexual movement that things that people are not just female and male. There's a push towards a non-binary descriptor of humans. That's happening in the week.
Okay, so then go question.
Okay, so I'm just wondering if this is part of the global story having to change. If the global story of this holiness, Dalai Lama said, you know, we can't have any more us and them. That's last century. So for me, that the cause and effect came into. Well, I'm delighted about that there can't be a cause, because cause seems to
you're completely losing me in your complex and marvellous issue with the philosophical presentation.
Oh, okay. I'm talking about us
question,
and me and
you. You asked a question. You said you had a question.
I want to know if you think that this push for non-binary gender and this push for ageism and this push for all that is a part of a movement that shows that the consciousness is shifting, that we are changing.
It's another variation of attachment.
Okay, great. That's all I need to know.
Another variation.
Okay.
I mean, go back to the Greek times, and all the men had boyfriends. There was no problem with binary. They were happy with homosexuality. It just keeps changing in different places, different times, different cultures. The things we get fixated on.
Great. Love it. Okay.
Good. In a way, the whole business, it's not trying to be horrible, but it's all, everything we do, there's an aspect of goodness here that can be. You know, racism, all these business. They are dualistic and awful, but it's just another variation of dissatisfaction, you know. So I know I'm a boy, I know I'm a girl, I think I'll be a boy, now I'm a girl, now I'm not a boy, I'm not a girl, whatever. It's just dissatisfaction. We're always dissatisfied with something and keep wanting to change it. But in the bottomless pit sense, there's nothing wrong with changing this, that's good progress and that's cool, but it's got to be based on compassion and wisdom. When change comes on the basis of compassion and wisdom, that's the real but non-binary, non-dualistic growth.
Yeah, well, that's not happening.
And that's exactly right.
No. The racism, and there's a push towards, this thing, you know, you can ask someone if they speak another language, because they happen to have, this happened to me, I was in a restaurant and I said, oh, do you speak Hindi? Because I just come back from India. And the person just turned to me like I was making a racist comment, you know. And I said, well, look, you know, some people think I'm Jewish.
I'm lost. I'm completely losing you.
Well, okay. I'm just saying part of it too. There's that coming up as well. You know, there's
so all push the, okay, the way.
So I'm just interested that you're finding that another way of describing attachment. That's all.
It is. It's all it is. But the whole point about ego. Okay, so this ego grasping is a colloquial term that's used for the deepest, most primordial, the Buddha would say, misconception. It's the source of every problem at all. You know, it's the cause of being, the more me, the more other. Logical. So when you cut down the neuroses, that's why that boy, that man on the television we saw, we were agreeing, he just looked like, almost had no sense of a separate self, like his blissful sense of connectedness and love and compassion. That's the consequence of letting go of these neuroses. The more you have neuroses, the more you have ego grasping, the more you have attachment, the more you have aversion, the more separate, the more neurotic, the more harmful, and the more suffering. The less of those, the more empathetic, the more connected, the more compassionate. It's like between negativity and positivity, and these are literal terms in Buddhist psychology. So this is what we have to learn to cultivate.
Yeah.
For our own sake and the sake of others. You still have relative reality, it's black and it's white, it's pink and it's blue, but there's no neurotic judgment on it. There's no neurotic aversion or attachment to it. But we can see attachment pretty primordial, and the whole universe runs on it, which is me and other, you and me. Mm. Isn't it? Mm. Yeah. It's like tea time, you people. Yeah. Or something. So then I did say, Rachel, when you come back, we'll do a little meditation to try to taste the pure nature of our mind. Thank you. See you soon.